okay, I had to change the phone, so we had to go to a new file. We had to stop. In answer to your point about pounding the satellite laser beam, no, that's not what I was saying. Don't know what you're referring to, but what we have here is that Ezra Pound is the real guy in the radio era of the teens and 20s. But he is in a cultural war against the 1840 to 1900 phase, because that's the British Victorian culture and poetry, which he thought was totally ill-equipped to handle the beginning of the 20th century. So he is battling what was the hidden ground era of radio, 1840-1900, and he's battling it as radio surfaces.
Mm-hmm.
So he's definitely the origin for the Android's meme, the Android meme's replay of Pound via LaRouche.
Right.
Is because Pound was the origin of that paranoid top-down confrontation of the global conspiracy.
So, whereas LaRouche was actually active during this monad quadrant, Ezra Pound's being retrieved.
Yes. The Android meme is retrieving and replaying Ezra Pound in a new kind of context. It's like an archetype being retrieved as a cliche probe, right? The car is the knight in shining armor, but it doesn't look like a knight in shining armor, but it's a replay of that effect.
Mm-hmm.
So that LaRouche is a poet and engaged in cultural studies like Pound did with he ransacked history, but he's doing it, he's retrieving the archetype of Pound as a cliche probe, or the Android meme is doing that, retrieving the archetype of Pound as a new cliche probe, and therefore would not look at all like Ezra Pound. Matter of fact, LaRouche considers Ezra Pound a dupe of the oligarchy in his own writings.
Right.
But that's the confusion or distortion that the Android does when it replays the archetypes. Remember, the word archetype is in the title of the Dobbs formula chart, how the media archetypes fit the Battle of Jericho in American politics.
Mm-hmm.
So Pound is essentially operating in Europe, but this is the Android meme. It's globally, but it's focused coming out of the United States, so we have an American character, Lyndon LaRouche.
Right. And Pound is sort of opposite Patsy Cline. Is that significant?
Ezra Pound is high culture. Patsy Cline is lowbrow folk culture.
Mm.
She sings on the Grand Ole Opry and crosses over. She's a really good singer. And we feature her in Who's Forgotten Furry Lind? And she's able to cross over and be popular in mainstream, non-country music audiences.
Mm-hmm.
So Patsy Cline, though, the sentimentality, the her songs, Crazy, Walking After Midnight, there's a small-town sensibility there, which is the world of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And she is an Android meme image of that. Her themes. I mean, she dies about 1963, and she's real popular like in the late 50s, early 60s, right around this 1960 period.
Mm-hmm.
You ever heard her stuff?
Yeah, I guess I've heard it on Furry Lynn.
Furry Lynn. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
on that same line, you have base and sacral chakras. Is there a relation across that line from there, from base and sacral chakras to Patsy Cline and Ezra Pound? Are those, is that meant to relate because they're on the same line?
Approximately, because I said that the radio meme is a primitive meme compared to the later quadrants. And so the primitive instinctual level, which is representing the base and sacral chakras, right?
Mm-hmm.
The bottom of the spine. It's like starting at the bottom of the body that the Android meme is building. So you begin at the base and the sacral chakras, and that's the the ancient meme of the holopathic radio. I mean, it is retrieving a long time ago, 1840, 1900, 47 to 57.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So,
Then cultural studies is opposite lung cancer. Is there a relation there?
No, we're not going to, you can't match it up exactly because the resonating interval is not matchable exactly. That's too much merging, too much matching, because there's also the separateness and oppositeness. They're more lined up in the later quadrants so that you see the disease meme is in the same position in the McLuhan quadrant, right above Bob Dylan, just as lung cancer was above Patsy Cline. They're lined up that way. They're lined up to stay in a theme.
Right.
So I repeat the structure in each quadrant.
So it makes more sense to look for correlations in the vertical column as opposed to the horizontal rows.
Yeah, yeah. So you could make some. I mean, the tree. Why do I have the tree there? I also have director. Now, director is more, it can be director of a corporation, it can be J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, it can be a movie director, and then you move down to the McLuhan quadrant as detective, then in the Thompson quadrant it's cowgirl, in the Coker quadrant it's lawyer, in my quadrant it's producer, so that the meme, the quadrant resonates and creates a certain kind of preference for a director versus the cowgirl or producer. The director is still that semi-industrial hierarchical area tradition in the radio era. As McLuhan said, radio, in the radio era, people took the new medium, radio, to do the work of yesterday, to do the old 19th century work as the content of radio. So the hierarchical positioning and power of the director is symptomatic of the effects of radio. Okay? But when you get to the television era, since everybody's in an information environment that's blurry and hard to figure out, it's more tactile, then everybody's turned into an information hunter or a detective.
Oh, okay.
It's more decentralist than radio.
Well, in the same sense that everyone becomes a detective in the triad quadrant, is you're saying everyone becomes a director in the monad quadrant, or there's
not everybody becomes one, but they are revolving around a charisma that comes off in the TV era around the detective. I mean, there's all kinds of TV detective shows,
right?
But the director is more resonant with the charisma effect of radio, where they're still like the Churchills and the Hitlers. They're directors of the country, of the economy and of the country. They're charismatic leaders. They're hierarchical.
Yeah, and they initiate people under them to be directors who initiate people under them to be... like a military hierarchy.
Right. But then everybody starts spying on everybody else in the TV age.
Oh.
Everybody's spying, not just half the world spying on the other half. Because everybody is in the same, what McLuhan called, interrogative mood. Since it's hard to tell what's happening in the TV era, because it's such a new, different medium, it's a full-blown tactility that no culture is prepared for it. So people start an instinctual curiosity to find out where it's at. A phrase made popular in the TV era, right?
Yeah, everybody's looking to see who knows what, but they're not spying on each other in the sense of everybody...
Political, hierarchical paranoia, no.
Right.
They're actually all collectively in a mood of schizophrenia. It's hard to decide. This is when people start to get bothered by the image and the charisma of the image taking over traditional political goals or platforms or issues.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So, it's also the era of pattern recognition. And so a detective is someone looking for the causes and effects within a pattern.
Yeah.
So then you know why Cowgirl comes in with the computer?
No.
Because by that time, you've got a right hemisphere computerized speed up environment that's favoring the woman. And so that's the beginning of the feminist movement, 67 to 72, or at least the second wave of feminism, they call it. So the cowgirl, the half man, half woman, unisex, the feminist image of the girl no longer being limited to the stereotypes of being a girl, taking on some of the freedoms of the boy. So the charismatic icon is the cowgirl. Tom Robbins' book, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, was popular in that period.
Right. Since we just have a few minutes, why don't we just nail a couple last things down in the LaRouche Monad quadrant, such as
right.
KISS.
Well, you have to juxtapose that with the other quadrants. You've got fellatio cunnilingus in the McLuhan quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
You've got unisex in the cowgirl Thompson quadrant. You've got joined at the hip in the Croker quadrant. And then you have cyborg sex, a horny device, you could say.
Mm.
So the simple chemical body archetype of male-female kissing is the epitome in that radio era.
Yeah, movies in that time probably, you know, yeah, the KISS was the big deal.
Right, McLuhan used to say that kissing wasn't as popular or had a different effect on television. He said the KISS hisses on television. It's too hot for a cool medium.
Yeah.
And so...
loses some of its romantic charisma that it had in the movie.
Yeah, or maybe the polarity between male and female.
Yeah, and also, in the movie, you're having everyone's having an individual experience. They're being sort of moved in their own little space. But in TV, everybody's sitting around the TV, and they all have to sort of... Their own intimacy is now getting bounced off of each other, and it becomes irritating.
Well, you end up with the group grope and the orgy, the public orgy, the private orgy, because the discarnate effect is scrambling the chemical body. So it doesn't know what's inside or outside or whether it's a girl or a boy. So, and also for American culture, being a kinetic culture, the tactile massage makes the kinetic aspects of Americans neurotic. They translate tactility, which is not just contact, into hyper-contact. So everybody starts getting horny and screwing everybody.
Mm-hmm.
The sexual revolution. So that's the tactile effect of television on the kinetic visual culture.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
That's the beginning of deep throat and, you know, fellatio cunnilingus. Well, porn starts coming in the late 60s. Now, this is 1965, 57 to 67.
Right.
I Am Yellow. I Am Curious Yellow was, I think, the breakthrough movie out of Sweden about 1966, 67. And Blow Up also, which is the movie in the McLuhan Quadrant, was famous for showing a bit of the private parts of a woman. It's a very quick glimpse, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But that made a very intellectual movie popular. Surprised Antonioni, the director.
Mm-hmm.
So the...
It surprised him?
Yeah, that his movie became so popular in the mainstream culture.
He didn't realize he was taking a risk by showing private parts in his movie?
I don't know what he thought he was doing. I mean, maybe he cynically was trying to get a mass audience, but back then, people generally weren't allowed to see that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And for some reason, people got to see it, or the censors had loosened up for that period, 66, 67.
And from that period on, it became a battle between the censors and the people who wanted to push...
The images
farther in order to create a bigger sensation.
Right, and basically the images won for a while, and the censors were weak because under the tactile effect of television, decentralist or authoritarian radio control, Big Brother control was weakened, was shocked. It retrieved it, you know, reestablished its authority, attempted to anyways in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
With the neocons. But it was thrown for a loop in the middle and late 60s. All kinds of permissiveness, which the 60s is known for now, right?
Yeah.
Burst on the scene, caught the old radio control trippers by surprise.
Right. Until by the 80s and 90s, strip clubs are just part of the culture now. They're celebrated as being part of what how people relax after work.
Right. So that's very different from the 70s or in the 80s. But you have it. Remember the phrase in that McLuhan zone is, if it feels good, do it.
Mm-hmm.
So the what else is in there?
Number seven.
Number seven represents the fragmented visual culture and numerical charisma of the lucky number. To be lucky means you got a bit of a hierarchy. Someone's luckier than someone else.
Mm.
And it's not a round number. It's a pointed number. It's a fragmented shape, a splintered off shape.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So it represents visual space. And kinetic man and the numinosity of number in that period.
Mm-hmm.
Of the Gutenberg galaxy.
And the ant?
Well, that's the industrial worker.
Oh, okay, the worker ant.
Yeah.
That's good. And in the musical scale, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, it's do.
That can be anything, any scale, but if you put do in there, it looks like do.
Oh,
people
yeah.
had to do things.
Right.
They had to work hard like ants.
Yeah.
So let's end with that.
Okay.
Bob Dean. Bob Dean is there since that's a name that came out of Toronto that was misidentified with Connie, whose public name was Carolyn Dean.
Connie? Nobody would call Connie Dobb. Nobody would call Connie Bob.
No, Carolyn Dean.
Yeah.
She took the name Dean from Garrett Dean. Her real name was Connie Dobbs, right?
Yeah.
So when she took on the public role of being a doctor after being in espionage for decades, she took on the name Dean. And then we've been through this before. Bob Marshall was identified with Carolyn. They thought that he was married to her. And they thought his real name was Bob Dean, and that she took the name Dean from Bob Dean. But all this is about chemical bodies. What's the name, since I'm Bob Dobbs and I'm an image for most people, they never met me, when they want to say that I'm really somebody else, they want to anchor my identity into a chemical body, they say that I'm Bob Dean from Nova Scotia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay?
Okay.
So remember, that's happened when I was on the radio. So it's a reference to the radio situation at CKLN, and it's a reference to the chemical body beginning to be discarnate. So that's the reason Bob Dean is put there.
Oh, right. So I think we've done a nice job of digging into the monad quadrant.
Right. Monad comes from Leibniz, and it's usually the idea of an autonomous subjectivity, or of a God being, or of a private settled consciousness, something, even the Vedanta soul, whatever the word is in the Vedanta. So it resonates with God. It's like
one,
the monad.
One without a second.
Yeah, yeah. Is that how they define it?
Well,
that's good enough.
It would have
one
to
without
be.
A second. Yeah. The unity or oversoul that everybody thinks they got. So the radio.
If it were the source or the one without the second, it would have to be that our deepest nature, which is the same in each of us.
Right, and that's right. And so that's the uniform effect of radio, allied with the visual homogeneous effect.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's. So monad and God fit, and then the secret about hadron is that it's a pun on the kitchen cabinet around President Reagan.
Uh-huh.
they formed, certain members of the people in that cabinet formed a company called Hadron, and that led into the Promise software scandal.
Oh.
So this is May Brussel kind of information, that there was a conspiratorial element around Reagan's cronies that led into a lot of scandals in the 80s. That's the embed of Hadron, and I've never told anybody that before.
Yeah, that's cool, but I don't know why it's in the Monad quadrant.
Well, because it's talking about somebody.
Oh, yeah, it's a May Brussel issue.
It's a May Brussel Macbeth coup.
Oh,
You know the story about Promise Software, is that Pentagon, the CIA, or some secret element in the American government, supposedly American government, sold it to embassies around the world so they could spy on those embassies.
Yeah, in other words, they put back doors into software that they sold.
Yeah. Well, Hadron, the people around Hadron were charged with being connected to that conspiracy.
Oh, okay.
So there's a bit of political intrigue right embedded in the subatomic particle.
Right.
And conspiracies in the information age of last 30, 40 years, it's done by little groups, which are tiny little subatomic particles compared to the millions of crowds and archetypes that we swim in every day.
Mm-hmm.
In the media swill, right?
Right. And, why is the element ether in this column?
Because ether was the physics concept of the world, and what matter was in the 19th century that Einstein refuted.
Right.
It also refers to vitalism, a 19th century occult philosophy.
Right.
So it's referring to the astral body categories.
Yeah.
But it's ether because radio made people discarnate, but they didn't fully see it because it was acoustic and they couldn't see it. And only people like Wyndham Lewis and James Joyce could see the discarnate effect, and Lewis was maybe the first to see it and wrote many stories and poems on it and plays. It was like ethereal at that point. Lewis called them the discarnate state, angels.
Well, they used to think that light waves and radio waves needed to have a medium through which to propagate, and that ether was that medium.
Yeah, it was the container. That was the legacy of.
Well, I think it was the medium. It's like if you had a bowl.
Well, a medium is a container.
Right.
A vehicle, a conduit.
Yeah.
Now they might argue with the details of what I'm saying, but basically the idea of a medium or something that contained the other parts of physics and substance, that's a visual metaphor.
Right.
Because non-visual spaces don't have conduits. They have resonant juxtapositions, shaping mechanisms.
Right. Restate that? What did you just say?
The non-literate, non-scientific, non-industrial cultures don't have the idea that one medium contains another.
Yeah.
They see different media creating their own spaces and are juxtaposed to other media spaces.
Oh, okay.
So, and I add one more word to that. The juxtaposition, so that sculpture for pre-literate societies is not a container. A sculptured space is not contained or a container, but is a shaper.
Right.
The ether has the leftover visual space, like the whole radio quadrant does itself.
Mm-hmm. Listen. We skipped over. What about the polarity here between Paris and Egyptian? I noticed you didn't say Paris and Egypt. You said Paris and Egyptian.
Yes, the radio era retrieves Egyptian sensibility. I'll have to go into that next time, and compare it to the Chinese and New York. Mm-hmm. See, I can come back to the LaRouche quadrant as I develop the McLuhan quadrant.
Okay.
So basically, Paris is the telegraph, is the capital of the world in the late 19th century in the telegraph era that is building the radio environment, and it's a retrieval of Egypt.
In what sense?
It's a sculptural Eiffel Tower, the modern pyramid.
Oh.
That was a huge construction.
Yeah.
So the point is that Egyptians are a tactile sculptural society.
Hmm.
And they're beginning to deal with the effects of writing. Paris is going in the opposite direction. It's coming out of the effects of writing and visual print and moving into the tactile sculptural 20th century.
Right.
William Irwin Thompson talks about the Paris being the capital of this transition from the 19th century into the 20th century. The developments there, modern science, modern art, modern music, everything came out of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
At least, it was building from the 1840s up to 1900 through the symbolism and Baudelaire and all those people, but it really crystallized by 1900.
Yeah. Well, politically, I guess there's not a lot of resonance between Paris and Egypt.
Oh, yes, there is. It's out of Paris is the remember the Dreyfus trial in 1896. The anti-Semitism of the Dreyfus scandal comes out of Paris.
Mm.
There's a lot of conflict and conspiring of political groups and memes focused in Paris
mm-hmm.
and London.
Mm-hmm.
Paris is very important as a nexus of the world government.
Right.
Remember the Treaty of Versailles at the end of World War I, the big factor leading into World War II. But the LaRouche does a lot of history on the 1890s in Paris, laying the groundwork for what happens leading into the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, Paris is a very important place at that time, and it's a lot of conspiracy for control and directing the global village. Okay?
Okay. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Signing off for March the 17th.